Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome to the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast.
Whoa, what are these kids doing in here? Hey, if you're under 18, go ask your mom. Now that we're alone, let's start the show.
Sandra just came.
Hello, naughty monkeys. If you are listening to this in public, on a bus, or around your coworkers, you get extra kudos because I love hearing about how much you laugh and get turned on around people when you listen to the show.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that.
It's really strange and fun.
On a bus? Yeah, like, I like that bus was the first thing that came to mind. If you're listening to this on a bus, or Sandra likes the bus.
I just love when you're around all the people, the woman carrying the groceries, and like
sure.
The mom with the kid, and like the angry man in the corner, and then you're
the guy who's everybody's friend. What's up with you? Hey, nice goggles. That happened to me on the bus recently. This old man said that to a girl. Nice goggles.
Always adventure on the bus. Okay, before we get into today we're talking about STIs, sexually transmitted infections, and what we can do to protect ourselves, dating, all that stuff. I mean, it's an important topic.
Yeah.
Like, way important. But first off, just to let you know, a bunch of cool stuff's going on in the LA area. So if you're a listener in LA, I'm telling you, the Pleasure Chest, I'm teaching a free class on blowjobs September 12th, which is a Wednesday. So that's coming up. You can come out. It'll be lots of fun. But seriously, guys, September 13th, Thursday night, the Pleasure Chest is having the Glory Hole Party. And if you didn't go last year, it is crazy fun.
Everyone gets laid.
There's a lot of naughty things. There's a spanking booth, and there's free alcohol. You have to go to their website and RSVP so that you have to get on the list. But if you're over 21, I highly recommend you coming out September 13th because it's going to be crazy, and I want you guys to get free booze and have fun with us because it's going to be goofy, and I'm going to be running around being silly. Anyway, and then Catalyst Con, if you're a sex-positive person who wants to be around sex-positive people talking about how to better the world, Catalyst Con is the 14th through 16th. I'm going to be on a panel Saturday morning on podcasting.
Even if you're a sex negative person who wants your mind changed.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that.
Yeah, do
maybe
that.
Those people.
Totally. So you can go to catalystcon.com. But seriously, cool things coming up mid-September. I don't know what's going on, Dave, but
September's a good month. My birthday's at the end of the month.
Oh.
Yeah. Also, hey, every Tuesday, you should come to Holy Fuck. It's a stand-up show in downtown LA.
Do it. It's very fun. I need to come again. I don't know why.
Yeah, it's been a while.
It has been a while. I'm kind of shy. I never have, like, Tuesday night. It's like, oh, I should just show up by myself and laugh alone.
Well, don't come by yourself.
I know, but getting
you can come with me. I go every week.
Yeah, and you look so relaxed when you're there because you're like the producer man. You're so
I'm getting better about it slowly but surely, like more and more and more relaxed.
Well, that's good.
I'm like 95% hugs now at that show. Used to be about 10. I would always be nice and happy to see people, but like, I gotta go. That's the way it is to run a show.
No, I totally understand. I mean, me before a live show for the Sex Nerd Sandra, I'm like,
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I know. I'm pretty relaxed at those.
Anyway, so I'm about to introduce our guest, but beforehand.
What's up?
Well, Dave, honestly, it punctuated recently. We were chatting, we're bonding, being friends. Mm-hmm. It punctuated the importance of this episode recently because you'd mentioned that you...
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. I hooked up with a girl who we'd slept together like two or three times, and then she said, maybe it was just once, I don't know. She was like, you know, I'm on the pill, so we don't have to use condoms. And I was just like... Yeah, anyway.
That doesn't even make sense.
I mean, it makes sense. I mean, it makes sense in people's heads. I get it.
If you are like an alien from another planet and your only fear is pregnancy, but there's so many things you can get from people.
I would imagine that her logic was that she'd been tested and she'd assumed that I'd been tested. But she should not have assumed that I'd been tested. I have been, but, you know, that's a weird assumption to make.
Right, and we're going
to
talk about what tests can cover and what tests can't cover. You know, because it's...
Yeah, they don't all cover everything.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, but I found it... because it's something that a lot of people do. It's like, oh, you're a nice guy, and I've only been with a couple of people, and I'm sure we're fine. We're fine.
You know, we're fine.
That's fine.
We're fine. You know? Yeah. I had all. Oh man, I made so many mistakes when I was younger. It just gave me so much anxiety. Yeah.
Totally. So joining us at the Nerdist Industry Studio today is Patty Kaysen. Hello, Patty Kaysen.
Hello, Sandra.
Hi, Patty.
Welcome to the table. Dave. Patty is a nurse practitioner in the LA area, working with people around sexual health and STIs. Patty, tell us about what your work's about here.
Well, I've been seeing patients for 30 years in various kinds of women's health settings. And a lot of what I do is also training healthcare providers in a variety of things having to do with STIs and contraception and cervical cancer prevention and sex. That's my favorite thing to teach people about and help training. Yeah, help try to change the hearts and minds of healthcare providers regarding talking to their patients about their sexuality.
And we've talked about the lack of training in medical and schools. You know, so the fact that you're filling in the gap is really important.
Yeah, that's great.
And two different sex educators in the LA area recommended that I talk to you specifically about these things. So you have come double recommended. Like I was like, oh, Patty Kaysen. Oh, you got to talk to Patty Kaysen. Everyone's like, Patty Kaysen. So I'm like, okay, I'll talk to Patty. Patty Kaysen is the person to talk to. She sounds awesome. But just so you guys know who's listening, if you're listening, that doesn't make sense.
If you're listening, not just hearing
this. It could just be in the background.
This is going to be
to pay attention.
This is going to be a two-part episode, basically. This week, we're going to be talking about STIs. And next week, we're going to be talking about contraception with Patty. So just so you know, we're splitting it up into two separate sections, but it's going to be all this juicy information and fun times. So, you know, get ready.
Very
strap
juicy.
In. Juicy.
You can eat this.
Dripping.
You can eat this podcast.
It's ripe.
Someday. Delicious. We'll have that technology.
Okay. So first off, you said something amazing before we started.
Did I? Thank you.
About healthy sex, because so much of talking about STIs and STDs and risk prevention, it gets very scary, and it gets really kind of, you know, it activates fear feelings and worry feelings. But you said some stuff about healthy sex and the shift of focus that you want with people.
Well, that's originally why I started to talk to healthcare providers about sex. Because I feel like we as healthcare providers are exposed to the worst of the worst. Each one of the people that you're talking to on these podcasts has their own experience. But mm-hmm. for us, we see hundreds of them, and we see the bad stuff. Mm-hmm. So we see all the STIs and all the unplanned pregnancies and all the bad ramifications from those things. So we start to feel like sex is frankly bad. Because, mm-hmm. you know, let's just try to get them to stop having so much, and then they won't have all these things that are associated with the risk that sex does entail. So one of the things I try to do is to change that paradigm a little bit. And one of the ways that I do that is to talk about some of the literature that we have, the data that says that sex is really good for your cardiovascular health. It makes you look younger. it's wonderful in terms of mood mm-hmm. and psychological health. There are even data, believe it or not, this is surprising and not exactly very condom positive, but that semen actually is associated with lower rates of depression in women. So women being exposed to semen, so for heterosexual, unprotected sex, they have lower rates of
Man,
Dave's
I know,
wagging his tail over there.
I know people that you should not say that to, is what I was thinking.
Well, I think that the data are interesting but preliminary and certainly not in any way going to outweigh the benefit of using a condom, either a male or a female condom.
Sure.
Not in any way. But if you are in a relationship where you're mutually monogamous, you've been screened, you're not concerned about HPV, and you are able not to use a condom with that particular person for that particular time in your life, you may have a benefit from the semen. And then again, maybe those data are just bunk and it's not actually going to be replicable. But there are some intriguing. But that's just kind of funny, a funny story.
I look forward to them doing more research on that because I've looked at it. I'm like, it could also be like your relationship style or connection. It could be like a lot of things. We'd ask the...
I just imagine, I'm just imagining someone using that data in the wrong way.
Oh, yes, they could. Yes, they could. And
well,
so,
you know, baby, you'll be happier.
You'll be so much happier if you let me take this thing off.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I've had no whatever. Getting into the
what just happened? To
oh
you
no,
there?
I was going to talk about. I immediately thought about things.
She was thinking about the one time she didn't use a condom, and then she thought she maybe didn't want to share that.
Like being a female and having slept with men, like when that has happened in my life, to be like, a condom, you know, it's much better. You know, just like them trying to convince me that.
Does that happen to you?
It has. It's been years, but it has happened, and it's really irritating.
Wow. I mean, I don't want to put myself on a high horse, but that's like, I've never done that. You know what I mean? You know, it feels better. So I know we just met an hour and a half ago, but I'm an asshole.
Well, I know we're not doing a segment on anything to do with intimate partner violence, but one of the main things that we look for in a relationship when a woman says that her partner takes the condom off without telling her, we consider that to be a sign of reproductive coercion, otherwise known as intimate partner violence.
I didn't even know about that phrase, intimate partner violence. That's really upsetting. Oh my God. Okay, well, that's a no-no, guys. Don't do that.
Yeah, don't ever do that.
Yeah.
Ever.
Ever. What is the difference between an STD and an STI? Because I want to clarify terms, because I say both of those together in a sentence a lot, because I know that people know STD, sexually transmitted disease, but not as many people are familiar with STI. Can you clarify those two terms?
Sure. There's no difference between the two. You can use them interchangeably.
Okay.
Sexually transmitted disease implies disease, that there's a disease going on, as opposed to just simply you've gotten an infection. Infections are viruses, funguses, bacterias, intermediate organisms, things that you you're not born with and that aren't going to persist necessarily in your body forever. So it's more of a transient thing, and it's something that's from a foreign object coming into your body. A disease more implies that something's wrong with you. Internally, you have an illness, and it's something more endogenous. The word endogenous means coming from inside of us. So we just thought it was a little more accurate to say infection, and also a little bit less stigmatizing. Mm-hmm. But the most important document that we have in the United States regarding treatment for sexually transmitted infections is called the STD treatment guidelines from Centers for Disease Control. And the most recent one came out at the end of 2010, and they haven't changed their nomenclature. So they say STD. So we aren't necessarily all on the same bandwagon in terms of changing the nomenclature. And it really doesn't matter. I think the important thing is that everybody understand that when you talk about an STD or an STI, you're talking about an infection that you get from having sex.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, by the way, you can get without having sex. There's a lot of STDs that are not necessarily transmitted just by having what we would define as sex.
Sure.
The most common one, HPV, is by skin-to-skin contact. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily have to involve sex. So.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
Many of them don't, right?
We definitely.
AIDS does not have to be sexually transmitted.
Well, right. It can just be blood, right. Body fluids, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
HBV, hepatitis B virus, same thing. Blood and body fluids.
I need to get my second vaccine on that. I keep putting it off.
Well, maybe you should go right now.
stop the recording. I need to get my Hep B vaccine. No, I got one in a series, and I just didn't get the others.
You should do that.
Yeah, I should. I know.
And HPV.
I did that.
HPV. I already have my HPV vaccine.
Good girl.
Me too.
Good
you?
Boy.
I think so.
Okay,
said
all
that
those women
said,
listening, don't have sex with Dave until we finish this series.
Balls
the worst PSA I've ever heard in my life. Don't have sex with Dave.
It's more important for men than women.
I did get an HPV vaccine. I just, I said that, you know what, never mind.
Did you get three?
I said it forgetting men, because I know men, like, it doesn't affect them, they just carry it.
It does affect them. Very
really?
Much.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I was just
in what way?
Yeah.
In every way. You can get warts on your genitals. You can get head and neck cancers. You can
really?
Get anal cancer.
This is something
it's
I was
really
completely
bad.
Unaware of.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, men don't mount a very good immune reaction to naturally acquired HPV infections. So we all get HPV. When we have sex and when our skin touches another human being's skin, we all get HPV. That's what happens. The vast, vast majority of us are exposed, get incidental infections, we clear them. Mm-hmm. But men, after they are exposed, get incidental infections and clear them, don't then mount an antibody response against that same strain very well in the future. So they'll just keep getting the same infections over and over again. As opposed to women who don't mount a very good antibody response but do mount one. Men mount virtually none. And so it's actually more important for men to get the full series of the vaccine.
Interesting. Well, then why do you think, I mean, many people have told me that that it's more hurtful to women than it is to men. Is that because it can become cervical cancer?
Yes.
Okay.
Because the main cancer that we developed the vaccine for was cervical cancer. The vaccine probably would not have been developed had it not been for cervical cancer prevention.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's one we'd all been paying attention to. Meanwhile, there's all these other things that nobody really, not many people know about. It's just like, oh my God. You know? So it is important. I mean, first of all, wait, you just differentiated between male and female immune system responses. Is that just in general that men don't tend to carry antibodies as much as women?
No, that's not just in general? That's not generalizable.
Oh, okay. That's just for HPV.
It's different for all. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The reason why we've tried to make an effort to involve more women in clinical trials is that traditionally white men were in clinical trials, so all of the data we had for years and years was on white men, which we thought would generalize to everyone, but it doesn't. Mm-hmm. As we know, everyone has, there's all kinds of different ways that our bodies respond when we are different ethnicities, different sex, different gender, rather. And so one of the examples of that is HPV, but it's different for each infection, different mm-hmm. for each illness.
That's so interesting. HPV is the one that a lot of people just don't know about. And whenever I teach my blowjob class, it's like, PSA, guys, throat cancer, just use
Absolutely.
A condom. But then then I go into like how to use a condom during blowjobs. And that's a whole thing is pleasure related to STIs. But this sounds really freaky and scary. I mean, and honestly, because you work with people, I mean, do you see a lot of stigma around STIs and like how people look at them? Like you'd mentioned something about before we started recording about people at risk versus not at risk and attitudes toward getting these infections.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like what are feelings that come up for people?
Well, I'll share with you in response to your prior point about teaching your blowjob class. When I was a brand new nurse practitioner, only about a year and a half out, one of my patients was a sex worker and we talked about does she use condoms every single time? And she says, yes, she uses condoms every single time. And I said, how do you negotiate that? Because a lot of what I've learned has been in the trenches with my patients. I also keep up to date with the literature, but talking to patients about sure. how they accomplish amazing things like having sex every day of their lives, even though they've been married for 35 years, or being a sex worker who uses a condom 100% of the time, I asked questions about how they do that. And she showed me, actually. She pulled out a condom and she used her hand, and she showed me how she gets a condom on her client without ever having them know that she's putting it on them.
Oh, wow.
Oh, sneaky.
Yeah, and actually a lot of sex workers do that. I have found out in future years. But when it first happened, my jaw was dropping. Sorry for the pun. But it was...
How did she do that?
Very sneakily, with her mouth. She put it in her mouth. She puts it in the side. She put it in the side of her cheek, and then she maneuvered it as she starts to go down on him. She maneuvers it in her mouth around his penis and uses her hand, and such that he doesn't even know it's getting on there. Because of all the... It's wet, and mm-hmm. He's not really looking to watch and monitor whether she's putting a condom on him.
Right.
And then she's making a lot of noise and doing a lot of distraction, and it's on.
Wow.
Interesting. And this is for blowjobs. Was she using condoms for blowjobs as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
She was, yeah.
Oh, wow. Now, she sounds like a superhero.
I think that somebody who's doing that a lot is pretty good at it. And they know how to... Now, in answer to your second question, they know how that they are at risk. So she knew she was at risk, and she knew that she needed to protect herself. And I think sometimes people that are in a position of being either in the adult entertainment industry or as sex workers, they will understand what their risk is, and they get screened more frequently. They take precautions in a way that's more effective than some people who don't know that they're at risk might be taking. They may not know to take precautions. But what I was saying to you earlier is that a lot of times patients that people, and if I use the word patient, it's just because that's the environment
folks
in which I've been having the interaction.
Peeps.
Yes. I may use the word people, women, client, patient, all in the same. I know I said the sex worker's client was, he's a client, but that's a different kind of client.
That is a different type of client.
We like to use the word client for our patients. It's very sort of politically correct.
Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, I might use the word patients also. So they, I think that somebody who has a history of having had sexually transmitted infections, we would, as healthcare providers, we would define those people as at risk, because somebody who has had a sexually transmitted infection recently, like chlamydia, for example, mm-hmm. the data are overwhelmingly clear that that person is the highest risk person in the population for getting another chlamydia infection in a short period of time. So anyone who's had a chlamydia infection, male mm-hmm. or female, any age, we want them rescreened in 3 months. Because very frequently, those tests would be positive again in 3 months. And that's a new infection. That's not the same infection that didn't get treated well by the antibiotic. It's a new infection. Maybe it's a reinfection by the same partner. Mm-hmm. But it's a new infection that, again, needs to be treated. So those people are at high risk, and they may not understand that, even if they've had a mm-hmm. couple of chlamydia infections. Because what puts somebody at risk to begin with is, unfortunately, sometimes the same sort of either geographical location that they live in, or community that they are, people that they hang out with and have sex with, or maybe their own sociological background or their own education level, whatever you want to put into that mix. But whatever made them vulnerable to that infection the first time is continuing to make them vulnerable, and often doesn't allow them to understand what kind of extreme vulnerability they're mm-hmm. at. Mm-hmm. And sexually transmitted infections are not equal opportunity in any way. Mm-hmm. I mean, women are more vulnerable than men, for one thing. And communities are at much higher risk than, some communities are at much higher risk than other communities.
Like who?
Well, they tend to be associated with lower socioeconomic areas. Mm-hmm. So somebody who comes from a lower socioeconomic area with exactly the same behavior as somebody who's in a higher socioeconomic area will have, that person from the lower socioeconomic area will have a much higher risk of getting a sexually transmitted infection, chlamydia or gonorrhea.
Oh, God, that could be so many things. Resources, education, like why that is the case.
It has to do with the fact that in that community that they're living in, they're probably having sex with people in that community, and there's much higher rates in that community. Mm. So they're at higher risk. Mm. And it's not fair at all. And healthcare, I've had many very spirited conversations with healthcare providers about, well, they just need to stop having sex in these risky ways. And it's, and I point out, well, okay, but if they were in that neighborhood doing exactly the same behavior, they wouldn't get the STI. So how is that fair? It's not about the behavior. It's about where they live.
It's not fair.
No, it's not fair.
Dave, make it
fair. Well, it's partially about behavior, right? And not necessarily, I mean, like, maybe I don't know that, but not the sexual behavior, but I mean, they're at more of a risk because there's less contraception being used, right? Or,
well, that's,
I mean,
another story. Yeah,
it's
also
just that all those people happen to have more STDs, right? I mean, these STDs spread in those neighborhoods for a reason.
Yes, right?
And the reasons are what, like education and available healthcare and things like that.
Yeah,
I
education,
also wonder,
available healthcare, people being afraid of healthcare because of
right.
past things that have happened that have been mm-hmm. negative based on their actual experiences or their friends and family's actual experiences.
Sure. I also wonder if in lower socioeconomic, I don't know what
hoods.
The last word.
Hood. Neighborhoods.
Hoods, that's
communities.
Communities, there you go. If more sex is being had, is there any data on that? Because it's so euphoric. I mean, if you're like stressed out because of money or because of whatever your situation is, you're probably more likely to have sex, right?
That's a really good question. Yeah, but there's, the interesting part is that people also have less sex when they're really stressed. People have less sex when they've lost a job. People have less sex when they are financially in a difficult situation. There's a
really?
Lot of crowding also in lower socioeconomic groupings.
Well, there's, yeah, that's it too. You're
the,
like
the body's
more likely to run into someone who might have sex with you
the body
when you don't
is less
live on
likely.
5 acres.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, that'd be nice.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
We're talking about my neighborhood right now, by the way. My house, my room.
Your 5 acre house?
No, I was talking about the lower socioeconomic.
Oh, right.
There's
yes.
a lot of people in his room for him to have
right.
sex with.
Yeah. all the time.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of horny
people. I just blow them up and then have sex with them. You know what I mean?
Oh, God.
You know, that's convenient because then they really, when you let the air out, they can pack down to a very small size. That's
Totally. And I can take them with me anywhere, but they have lots of STDs.
Oh, that's a problem.
Yeah.
You should try putting a condom on that.
Mm. Well, I bought them, so.
You could wrap her in saran wrap.
That's true. But I'm not a saran wrap guy, you know? I'm more of just like a straight up blow up doll. You know what I mean?
It's too bad because, you know, you can use saran wrap as a dental dam.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I've never used it as a dental dam, though.
I've never used a dental dam, ever.
Really?
Yeah, you're looking at me like
This is one more reason that maybe people shouldn't be having sex with Dave.
Oh, no!
Well, but how come?
Men are very vulnerable to getting HPV in the throat from oral sex with women.
Man.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
I don't want to make any kind of... I don't even want to make a comment that might reduce the amount of oral sex that's being had by women, so I pretend I didn't say that, but men are vulnerable to HPV infections in the throat from oral sex with women.
No, you know, I traverse different groups of people in this town, and I was at a party recently, and a friend of mine, we decided to kind of experiment with dental dams and kind of just see, you know, how that went. So we were kind of both, you know, working with each other. I explained what I knew about them, but it's still like an awkward, interesting experience to practice with them. But by and large, when I see in groups of people like playing, and I know there is some STI testing conversation going on, but I don't see a lot of it. And I don't know how much is actually being had. I don't see dental dams being used at all.
I don't see them.
Yeah.
I just don't see them.
The availability
in someone's cabinet in a store, I never see them.
Well, they're in the sex shops, but they're not in people's normal.
They're not at Walgreens
vocabulary.
Or whatever. Yeah.
Right. So.
Right.
Before we get into,
you can use a condom as a dental dam. You can cut it right down the center and stretch it. Works really well.
Yeah, and you can take a glove. I got this from Tristan Taramino and cut off all the fingers.
Like a winter glove.
No, like a latex or nitrile glove, and cut all the fingers off, leave the thumb, and like open it up, and then the thumb becomes a little condom for your tongue.
For your what? Okay,
your
you
tongue.
Said tongue,
yeah.
But it sounded like you said dung.
Dung.
And
I got excited.
Thought you had like a weird. I both thought that you had like a weird new synonym for penis, and that you said a condom for your penis. It becomes a condom for your penis.
The thumb, it really stretches. No,
the thumb stretches.
What are STIs? I mean, what are we talking about? Because when I go get screened, like at the Gay and Lesbian Center in Hollywood, I'll get the chlamydia, syphilis, gonorrhea, right? And then there's HIV. And that's pretty
about
much
it.
And I'm sorry, but I'm pretty aware that there's more than four STIs out there. And so in my most recent test, I asked the guy, like, how about hep C? Can I get tested for hep C? Because that's kind of important. He's like, you know, there's no funding for hep C testing. You know, you can. And he gave me a number to go and get hep C testing. But
you can get hep C testing at Planned Parenthood, can't you?
No.
Really?
No. It's not funded. Yes, you can get hep C testing at any laboratory, any healthcare provider's office, including Planned Parenthood, but you have to pay for it. What they were telling Sandra is that there's no state funding. Sandra's in California, and there's a state program that pays for chlamydia, gonorrhea, HIV, and syphilis testing. Now, that's not true in all states. Many states, that's not true at all. There's really not very good STI screening programs in different states, but hep C is not covered in any of them, hep C screening.
Wow.
But right now we're doing an initiative for people in my age group, so the baby boomer kind of age group, for hep C for everyone, because they're showing high rates of, you know, high percentages of positive hep C testing, but not for the entire population. So screening for hepatitis C is not generally considered part of screening for STIs. It's not generally considered, you know, it's not that we are asking everyone to have one lifetime test for hepatitis C like we are with HIV.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, quote, should know their status, unquote, with HIV. So everyone should have at least one lifetime test and then repeat testing as needed for any kind of new risk or exposure. That's not true for hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is not actually all that sexually transmissible.
Oh.
It is sexually transmitted, but it's primarily blood and body fluids other than sexually transmitted. A lot of discordant couples, one member of a couple having hepatitis C chronically and being infective, and the other one being negative. A lot of those couples never, the negative person never converts.
Huh.
Well, it's great to know.
So it's not all that much of a risk. Huh. But it is something that you would like to know about your partner if sure. they have yeah. chronic hep C.
Just going over the basic groupings of STIs in terms of just separating them within like treatable and untreatable, you know, that kind of thing. Can you just kind of lay the groundwork for what we're talking about when we say STI? What are we talking about?
Sure. So I just want to say preliminarily, any woman 25 and below should be screened annually for chlamydia, and then every time they have a new partner or if their partner has multiple partners. So you want to, if they've been exposed. So any female should be exposed, should be screened at least annually. And when I use the word screening, I just want to point out that means in someone who has no symptoms. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about just sort of healthcare maintenance kinds of things, not somebody who comes in with a symptom of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. Not someone who's coming in saying, quote, I want to be tested for everything just because I had an exposure or I'm worried or, you know, something like that. So we're talking about all comers. Sorry again for the pun, but just somebody
who's... No apologies for puns here at all.
We like cum.
Yeah. So all women should be screened annually for chlamydia. And then if they're the population that they live in, the area that they live in has at least 1% prevalence of gonorrhea, they should also be screened annually for gonorrhea. Mm-hmm. Both of those are treatable. They're very, very common. Mm-hmm. They're very transmissible heterosexually. They're very preventable by mm-hmm. condoms, both male and female. Less transmissible woman to woman, very transmissible where there's any penetrative receptive sex of any kind. So male to male, where there's any kind of penetration happening, and male and female together, where there's any penetration happening, very, very infective. Also possible to infect with oral sex. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm saying, any kind of penetration. But gonorrhea specifically is an obligate anaerobe, meaning that it doesn't really like to live outside of in an area where there's air. So it's less likely to be transmissible through the air and then into the body. It's not impossible, but it's a little bit more finicky.
Okay.
But in terms of just the general broad strokes, both of those organisms, chlamydia and gonorrhea, are things that you can protect yourself really well with barrier methods, with condoms and male and female condoms in many varieties of behaviors. And I just want to say for anyone who's going in to talk with your healthcare provider, please make sure that if they're not asking you about your specific behaviors, that you share that with them. We're trying to train all of the healthcare providers to actually ask specific questions about, it's called the 5 P's, and I'm not going to go into all of the 5 P's,
okay.
But essentially it's asking people not about are you gay or straight or, you know, are you married or not? It's about asking people, what do you do? Who do you do it with? What orifices are involved? How many people? And so it's about the specific behaviors.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're really trying to teach people to do. And so if your healthcare provider's not doing that and you're doing something that you have a question about, ask the specific question about the specific body part and the specific partner and what you're doing together.
Yeah, no one has ever asked me until I started going to the Gay and Lesbian Center about, like, do I have unprotected oral sex? I mean, no one had ever offered me a throat swab ever in my life. I mean, I could have had gonorrhea of the throat from like age 17 and I wouldn't have known, you know, like,
yeah,
no one
you would have known.
The good news is gonorrhea of the throat is not really, doesn't cause a lot of bad problems. Gonorrhea of the cervix causes really bad problems. Ooh. But not so much with the throat.
I have heard that there's a superbug gonorrhea that isn't responding to
yeah, we're in a bit of a problem situation right now, and I think we're responding very well nationally from a public health perspective by putting out alerts to all healthcare providers to change the treatment regimen that we use for gonorrhea. So the treatment regimen used to be half the dosage of an injectable mm-hmm. that we're now using. Now we're using double that dosage of the injectable, and we've added to that what is just coincidentally also the treatment for gonorrhea, mm-hmm. For chlamydia, mm-hmm. so that essentially when you're treated for gonorrhea, you're treated for both every time out. But that's not the rationale. The rationale is to give some support with the treatment by giving that extra antibiotic on top of the one that you're using for gonorrhea to try to prevent the development of resistant strains to gonorrhea, because we are seeing some increase in what's called MIC. It's an increase in the amount of antibiotic that you need to use in order to kill the organism, kill the gonorrhea. And there have been some resistant strains showing up in Hawaii, which is generally the first place we see it, and then it moves east. So we're asking all, especially really to make a big focus in the western states, but clearly all throughout the United States, to really limit to only this injectable medication and double the dose that we were before and adding the other medication, the other antibiotic on top of it. So doing dual antibiotic treatment and double the dose of the injectable. And there are have always been alternative antibiotics to the alternatives to the injection. So that is still possible and it's still written as a possibility, but it's really discouraged. We really want nobody to be using those alternative oral meds unless it's absolutely necessary, like you absolutely can't carry the injectable in your office for some odd reason, which I couldn't figure out why you couldn't carry an injectable in your healthcare facility. But if for some reason you can't, there's also the possibility in many states, California is among them, of treating partners of the patient that you've detected the organism in. So let's say somebody were to come in and see me and I were to diagnose them with gonorrhea, I am legally allowed to give them treatment for their partner. If there's no way on God's green earth this patient's partner is coming in for treatment, I can give that patient oral treatment for their partner. So that you can make an argument that sometimes you might have to do that because the partner's just not going to come in otherwise.
All right.
When you but say oral treatment for their partner, you're talking about a pill?
Yes.
Or like, okay. Okay. I was picturing like you would do something to their mouth so the
<That's just laughs>
next
gross.
Time they went down on them, then they'd be cured. Like, I know they have gonorrhea, but you have the cure in your mouth.
Cure by blowjob. Okay.
Cure by blowjob. That's the name of my next movie.
So those are curable, and those are very common. Syphilis is curable.
Syphilis, chlamydia.
Gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis are all treatable. Are curable.
Okay.
HIV, as you know, is treatable and not curable.
Right.
And then we get into the lesser. Then there's a whole slew of lesser sexually transmitted infections, all of which have symptoms, all of which are treatable and are beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about because they're rare and they're things that have symptoms. And if you had the symptom, you'd go in, you'd ask your healthcare provider. Hopefully they would give you a diagnosis and a treatment. So then we get into the little viral ones, herpes and the HPV.
Bieber fever.
Ah, herpes. That's some fun right there.
It doesn't sound fun.
It's fun because everybody has... Like, herpes is like... I think of Reefer Madness, where... Because of all the... I mean, I'm sorry, but of all the STIs that exist in the kingdom of sexually transmitted infections, herpes, to me, is not that bad. Like...
What a good attitude. I'd like to bring you with me to talk to all of my patients.
Yeah, it's... I mean, okay. It's a sore... And it's kind of like, oh my God, you have herpes. Like, you can't ever date ever again. But the truth is
it's a cold sore. You just got to put it in its place. That's right, Sandra.
I have a question. Okay, let's talk about herpes. This is a question from one of our listeners. Please clarify cold sores. Do we all just have face herpes and should we all just be okay with that? Like, because it's just, I remember in college talking to a girl who was flirting with this guy and she's like, don't tell anybody, but he told me he has herpes, and I just, like, herpes, like, it was the end of their romance. She couldn't. And at the time, I didn't know much about herpes. I just knew that you don't want it, so don't have sex with that person. I don't know. Tell me about herpes. Share.
Where would I begin? Well, so the first thing I want to say is that you're absolutely right. It's a cold sore, a fever blister, a sun blister. It's a cold sore. Put it in its place, right? That's all it is. You get a couple little blisters either on your lips and your mouth or your lips on your vulva or on your penis or somewhere else, maybe your butt. You know, there are other places you can get it. And then you have this painful thing for a few days and then it goes away. And really, if you're immunocompetent, what we call immunocompetent, in other words, you don't have any compromise to your immune system, that's that. So yeah, it's just that. And somebody that is a female and has herpes and has had it for a while has antibodies, just like anyone who has herpes has antibodies against herpes. Mm-hmm. And so if that woman were to get pregnant and carry that pregnancy, she's transmitting those antibodies to her fetus and then to the baby when the baby's a newborn. So that baby's actually not at a lot of risk of getting any kind of bad neonatal herpes sepsis, bad infection with herpes when it's born through an infected canal, because that baby's also got antibodies. Mm. The only people that are at the, and I shouldn't say only because it's not 100%, but primarily the vast majority of newborns that are at risk are those that are exposed to a brand new herpes infection. So mm-hmm. the mom develops a brand new herpes infection right at the time when she's going to deliver the baby, delivers the baby through an infected canal, and the baby gets herpes but doesn't have antibodies to fight it. Now, that's a pretty rare event, actually. Mm-hmm. It's not rare, but it does not happen very often. Mm-hmm. What people are so worried about with getting herpes is about all these ramifications with their pregnancies, but really, if you've got the antibodies, you're pretty protected. So mostly, it's not a big issue with obstetrics for mm-hmm. the most part. So let's just put that aside. So that's probably not a huge problem. And then you have the issue of there's two strains, right? There's herpes 1 and herpes 2. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, herpes 1 was lips, herpes 2 was genitals. But that actually is no longer true.
Oh, damn.
Because people do all these things.
Okay.
What do they do, Dave?
Oh, no. I just like saying his name and be like, Dave, oh, my God.
She thought that was a crazy thing to hear. Yeah. I wanted to.
I get excited. I'm sorry, Patty.
Express her excitement.
But since Dave doesn't know about dental dams, maybe he understands how you might get one genitally and two orally.
I mean,
sassy nurse practitioner.
Yeah, I would imagine that most people understand how to get herpes on your mouth. And I do know what dental dams are. But I would imagine that if you went down on someone who has genital herpes, then you would get them on your mouth.
Yeah, you would. And the most common way that you get what your person that sent you that question asked about face herpes, the most common way to get herpes on your lips is from your parents. Most of us who have, quote, face herpes got it from our parents, not from sex.
From going down on your parents.
Trying not to have an image of that in my head.
Use dental dams the next time I visit my parents.
Like when we got it forming in utero, or do you mean like just
little
sharing
kisses from your mommy,
sharing cups and things?
Kisses,
yeah.
Kisses from your mommy and daddy.
Yeah,
on your little face.
On your little
when
face.
When you're really little,
loving herpes.
Loving herpes. So. In fact, one little factoid that we could share is that the new infections that women are getting right now, the most likely new infection that a woman will get is genital 1, mm-hmm. HSV-1. Mm-hmm. So 1 just recently edged out 2 in terms of new herpes infections for females.
So there's a herpes 1, herpes 2. One was mouth, one was genitals, and now they're just sort of swapping and like,
yes.
You know, playing, you know, double dutch. Like,
yes. And you
could, just back and forth.
And you can get both, and you could get both in either area. Mm-hmm. A person could be positive for both and get them both in both places. A person could be positive for both and get one in one place and one in the other, and neither the two ever should meet.
Yeah.
And a person could have just one of the strains in one place and not in the other. And so any of these combinations are possible. What's some of the things to know about are that if you get one genitally, one does not like the genitals very much.
Okay.
So if you get one and that's the only strain you've got, you're unlikely to have a lot of frequent recurrences. Same thing with two on the lips. It's not going to come as frequently or for as, you know, mm-hmm. you're going to, with any herpes infection, over time you get fewer and fewer recurrences mm-hmm. and you tend to see it less. And there are people who have had herpes for 40 years and don't ever get it. They haven't had it in decades. Mm-hmm. There are people that in the beginning they get it every month or every 2 months, and then they'll slowly over time get it less and less frequently until they're hardly mm-hmm. ever getting it. There's also ways to suppress it with antiviral medications,
right.
Acyclovir, Valcyclovir, Famcyclovir, which mm-hmm. are Valtrex, Famvir, and Acyclovir is just, there's a lot of generics of it.
Sounds like you're speaking Latin.
I know. That's why I thought I'd say it fast. But there are these medications you take every single day, and then you reduce your own outbreaks, and you also reduce your ability to infect your partner. So if you are in a situation with a partner where one of you is positive and the other is negative, the one who's positive can actually take antiviral medication suppression mm-hmm. and be much less likely to give herpes to their partner.
I have questions about the testing for it. And I have questions about the transmission when you have an outbreak and don't. Because both those things seem really like...
So you can give somebody herpes when you don't have an outbreak. I'm going to use the term shedding virus, quote unquote. Okay, that term, shedding virus, means that I'm infective. Well, I'm not, actually. I don't think. But I just mean, in general, one would be infective. So if you are shedding virus, you are infective at that moment. So somebody can shed virus and never have a symptom. Mm-hmm. People can shed virus, know they have herpes, not know that they're having an outbreak and not actually be having any symptoms at all and still be shedding virus. Somebody can not know that they've ever had herpes in their life and still be infective and shedding virus. Any of these possibilities exist. So somebody that you're having sex with, if they're a new partner, for example, if they tell you, I've been tested and I don't have herpes, then it's important to find out what they mean by that. Because if they say that they had something on their genitals or on their lips and they were swabbed and that test came back negative, that doesn't mean that they don't have herpes. That means that that lesion that was tested was not fresh enough or wasn't to have had a positive test, to have been shedding enough virus that the test would show up positive, or that that lesion that they had tested wasn't herpes. Doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have the virus living on their ganglion, which is at the root of their nerve, which is where the herpes virus lives in between outbreaks. So the two tests that we do, one of them is a genital or a oral or skin swab.
Right,
that's
outbreak.
A culture. Uh-huh. Yeah. And then another one, and there's actually new testing happening with that, where traditionally it was always culture. Now they're looking at new molecular tests that are also the same thing, though, looking at skin. And then the second way to test is with your blood test. The blood test doesn't tell you whether that particular sore that you are worried about was or wasn't a herpes lesion. It tells you whether you've ever been exposed to one or two.
Dude, Dave, have you ever asked your doctor to get tested for herpes? Because it's really annoying. Have you ever done it?
I feel like I have. For one thing, I don't have a doctor. Oh. I don't have healthcare. I have gone to clinics that I believe I've been tested for herpes. I don't know. I think I've said that before. So I've never had a lesion. So I've never had like a specific sore tested.
Yeah. I'll ask because I know they don't like actively test for it. I'll be like, can I be tested for herpes? Test me for herpes. I don't know. I've never had a cold sore in my life. Test me for herpes. And they're just like, no.
Really?
Because they'll be like, us testing for herpes just means that you may have been exposed or around to it, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have it. And then I'm just like, ugh. I'm just like mad. Just test me.
Well, the thing is, if you did a blood test and your antibodies were negative for both one and two, then you know definitively that you do not have herpes. There actually is utility to the test. I'm gonna play the devil's advocate with the person that you talked to.
I guess they were just so like, it's gonna test positive. I guess just generally, I guess they'd seen so many positive tests.
The majority of people are positive, but if you've never had an outbreak and you've never even had a symptom that you think could have been an outbreak, either on your lips or on your genitals, you very well might be negative.
I want to be.
Some of my best friends are negative. So if you were negative for both, that would be important information. Because if you had a new partner and your partner wasn't negative, you would be able to have the conversation about whether your partner wanted to go on suppression. Mm. And that is something that's very transmissible skin to skin. This doesn't have anything to do with penetration. This has to do with skin touching skin. Same thing as HPV, skin to skin contact. That's what we care about. And so you're not very protected by a condom.
So yeah, HPV, condoms, why can't we have like full on like condom?
Body condom?
Like a condom for like the penis and the balls and surrounding, just like a nice doily napkin type, like lap napkin.
That'd be very nice. You know? That's why the female condom is so good, because it does cover a little bit more, but it still isn't completely protective. But you could cut a hole in a dental dam, put a female condom into it, have the dental dam covering all the other areas. We don't have good data on this, but it makes a lot of sense, because the areas of the body that are covered by a male or a female condom, you are protected against both HPV and herpes. Just not. It's just there's a lot of other areas that aren't covered.
Yeah,
it's just such a hard sell. It really is. I mean, you know.
Yeah, because you said you're not a Saran wrap guy.
Well, we not were yet. Joking about my blow-up doll collection then. No, I've never used saran wrap for pretty much anything, insects or baking at all. But, you know, I mean, you know how hard it is to get people to use condoms. Like, man, trying to convince people to wear, like, a bodysuit. just like, all right, put on this astronaut uniform and then we'll have pleasure between the two of us. It's too bad, but I'm just saying, that's a very hard sell.
Well, just remember that we have very strong immune systems. The immune system does a very good job of getting rid of HPV once we've gotten it. The vast majority of them we clear spontaneously all by ourselves. And herpes, well, it's a cold sore, so once in a while you get a little cold sore. So yeah,
sure.
The really bad things, like women can get some very bad things happening to them from having chlamydia or gonorrhea. Both men and women can have really bad things happening to them from having syphilis if it's untreated. Both men and women can have some pretty bad things happen if they get HIV. So really the ones that we can't treat and that we can't fully protect against aren't really the worst actors out there.
Sure.
Yeah. Put it in perspective.
Put it to rest, guys. No, it's honestly, for me, I worry about getting herpes mainly because of how people react to someone who has herpes. Like, I'm afraid to have it because then I'm going to have to tell every partner that I have herpes, and then they're going to make, like, do the sad face, and I don't want the sad face, you know?
Then I would agree with your healthcare provider. You don't want to get that serum test.
Right, because then I test positive. But I mean,
and what are you going to say? I'm positive on my test, but I've never had an outbreak? You think that that's going to reassure your partner?
Right, I mean, I've never even had a mouth sore. It's like, but I know some people have, so it's frustrating because I know it's important to protect yourself, but it's just so... I had a friend recently who I played with and who I know is herpes positive. And so we had our safe sex talk. And, you know, and I expressed that I wasn't comfortable at the time doing anything that, you know, would expose me. So mainly we did like hand play stuff with gloves and barriers and things. And so I... You know, and we just played around and it was nice. You know, it was a fun experience. And so you're still able to have lots of fun, even if you're not necessarily ready to have genital contact, skin to skin contact with somebody who's like, you can totally do a lot of really awesome, fun things, guys. I'm just letting you know, even if you are uncomfortable with that stuff. But I wish people were a little more calm about herpes because it really is distracting from the real things we should be worried about, like syphilis, you know,
and the economy.
And the economy. In the upcoming election. Jeez.
Syphilis is pretty rare, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
As opposed to HPV and herpes and chlamydia and
it's
gonorrhea.
Like, it's like hipster retro.
Yeah, I would imagine that the world worked pretty hard at evacuating us of syphilis.
We almost had eradicated it.
Really? Because, I mean, it was killing like lots and lots of people, what, 100 or 200 years ago?
Yeah. It's a bad way to go.
Yeah, I would imagine. This is like kind of a left turn, but what about yeast infections? Is that, I mean, I don't know much about them. I know that I'm pretty sure I got a male yeast infection once.
Jock itch.
Well, okay. I didn't realize that's what it was called.
Well, when it's down in your scrotal area, it's jock itch. When it's on your penis, we have a different name for it. But
no. Sure.
I had like a really bad UTI, and I went to the doctor, and they told me that I also had a male yeast infection. It was like discharge. It was awful. It's crazy.
Men don't usually have discharge from a yeast infection. It's usually skin irritation, red, peely, itchy, can be swollen, could be even painful because when you scratch it, it can inflame it. Did you know itching is just low-level pain?
I did not know that.
Hmm. It's the same receptors?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. That's cool. I mean, it's
low
not
low-level
cool.
Firing of a pain receptor.
Huh.
That's why red swelling is, yeah, because you make it pain. You switch it. You make it more intense.
Huh.
But yeah, men don't usually, just for all you people listening, if you have discharge from your penis, you probably don't have a yeast infection. It's probably chlamydia
or gonorrhea.
Maybe I had
two things at once, and I just wasn't paying attention.
Did the person treat you for chlamydia or gonorrhea?
No, they tested me for it, and I didn't have it. That's what I originally thought I had, because it was like after it showed up, the discharge showed up after sex, and I freaked out. I like WebMD'd my brain into explosion. You know, by the end of my 2 hours on WMD, I thought I had everything in the world, from like AIDS to a vagina. You know what I mean? And so I went to the doctor, and they were like, no, you have a UTI, and this is probably a yeast infection. And I was like, cool. So I took a bunch of Cipro, and that wasn't fun, but I felt better a week later.
But you also used cream for your skin. Good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, men can get yeast infections all on their own. Yeast likes warm, wet, moist, like environments that
don't
get...
Oh, so you don't need exposure to a female.
No.
To...
Oh. No. That's why men get jock itch all by themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of called jock itch because, much like manly. Athlete's foot, well, in both cases, what athletes do, they sweat. They don't change out of their clothes very quickly. So they've got a moist, warm environment that's been around for a while. So you take time plus warmth plus moisture, and that's a perfect petri dish for a fungal infection. We've all got yeast on our skin all the time, so when it's going from just a little bit of yeast on your skin that's not causing a problem, to which we call colonizing, to infection, that's the word we use when the thing overgrows quite a bit and takes over the environment. And so when you get that infection, it's because the yeast was very happy in the warm, wet environment between your toes because you're an athlete and you sweat it in your socks, or in your groin because you're an athlete and you sweat it in your jock strap. Mm. And you can also get it on your penis when you put your penis inside of a vagina that has yeast in it. And you can also do that and not get a yeast infection on your penis. It's very possible for a man to have plenty of sex with a female that is infected with yeast and not get it himself. They're not typically considered STIs in that way.
It's so interesting. It's just, I don't know, we're getting so deep into the details of things that are important, but at the same time, a lot of it's not as, it's treatable. It's not as dramatic. It's just mainly, what worries, what? Yeah.
I didn't see that you had that written down.
Yeah, my list of questions, I was like, Dave asked the yeast infection question. Excellent. But a lot of this is treatable, and the thing that worries me is when people don't even get tested for basics or go seek out free healthcare availability in their area because they're afraid that they might test positive for something. And it's be the worst thing ever. I knew a guy in college whose both parents had HIV that happened after he was born, everything. He had like another person in his family die from it. And he was terrified to go get tested, and he had unprotected sex with other males a lot. And like, it was just this whole thing. I was like, dude, stop, go get, do it. You know? And he was in a very high risk category, and he wasn't communicating.
Did he do it?
I don't know if he ever did it. Mm. No. I mean, I'd be like, you know, I'd see him in the halls and be like,
man,
do
was
it.
Paul Ryan.
Spreading rumors. There's nothing. It's so great to get your test back because then you know.
Oh, it's
and
the
you
best.
Can tell every, you know, you can tell everyone. Like, you can tweet it like I do sometimes, but like just actually just be able to let everyone know that you're dating for the next several months. You know, I got tested this date. I'm negative for this. I did test positive for chlamydia. I then got treated, and then I got tested 3 months later, you know, and then I was fine.
Sure.
I mean, to just...
Well, even if you are positive, then you get to deal with it, you know?
Yeah, and move forward.
Just get tested. You don't want to hurt yourself.
Oh, don't
I mean,
do that.
Come on now.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There is so much... I knew that we weren't even... There was so much... this is so much stuff. I say this so much, but so much STIs. There's so much information, but I really appreciate, Patty, you talking with us about this stuff. We're going to pick up on contraception, probably talk about safe sex talks and behaviors and what you can get from different behaviors, and then go into contraception and talk about hormonal stuff, especially because there are lots of questions people had about that. So
I wanted to say one thing about HPV testing.
Ooh. Oh, do.
If we have another minute.
Sure, yeah.
HPV testing is not done or should not be done in the context of somebody wanting to know whether or not they have HPV. That's not the state of the art of the testing right now. You could go get a test. If your provider did give you a, quote, test for HPV, and it was positive, it wouldn't really be able to tell you anything. It wouldn't tell you whether you were going to be positive the next day. You could clear that virus by the next day. Mm-hmm. So all it would do would be to confuse you and stigmatize you. Mm-hmm. HPV testing right now, there should be no testing done for the low-risk strains for anyone, for any reason, for any at any point. That just mm-hmm. shouldn't, there's no context in which that should be
there's
done
like
at this point.
40 different strains of it or
yes,
something?
But there's, yes, there are, but there's only about 14 that are the high-risk strains uh-huh. that are tested only in the context of trying to find out if somebody has a risk for cervical cancer. And then we follow through with doing special testing of that particular person to find out if they have precancerous lesions on their cervix that need to be treated. So there's a really clear context in which we do HPV testing on females only and only in the context of ruling out whether or not they have precancerous lesions on their cervix. So if people are going into their healthcare providers asking for HPV testing, hopefully the provider will explain this to them. But I would just really discourage anyone from ever asking for that. It doesn't, there's no utility, and the state of the art is just not there. We don't have the correct tests yet to be able to use them clinically with any mm-hmm. utility of any kind. And specifically, we can't test men.
Mm-hmm. So, and some people have mentioned to me that they've heard that you could stick a Q-tip down the urethra or kind of swab a thing. Or
the only time men are tested at this point is in the context of a research project.
Okay.
That's being done. And we do have research projects, lots of them. We have lots of information about HPV, but it's all in the context of research. We're just not there yet.
Mainly vaccinating.
Exactly. Thank you. The most important thing is for everybody, male and female, to get vaccinated of all ages, unless you are in a 100% mutually monogamous relationship, you're above the age of 26 and you're in a mutually monogamous relationship and you're quite certain that that's the last person you're ever going to have skin-to-skin contact with and you feel like you want to make that determination for yourself, everyone else should get vaccinated.
Now, I know that, wait, no, now I want to really like flesh this out though. If you're over the age of 26, because I read, it's not paid for. Okay, so under the age of 26, there's usually funding for getting vaccinated for HPV, but you can get it if you're over 26. Your doctor is allowed to give it.
Yes.
It's just that it may not be funded through your HMO or whatnot.
Right. And it's called, quote, off-label because the labeling for the two vaccines that are available on the market right now in the United States is for 26 and below.
Okay.
So for the one vaccine that only prevents the two high-risk strains, that vaccine's only indicated for females. Mm-hmm. And the other vaccine, the one that protects you against the two most common high-risk strains and the two most common low-risk strains, that's indicated for both males and females.
Gardasil?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's, we call it the quadrivalent, mm-hmm. four strains. By the way, the same company that makes the quadrivalent is coming out with a nine-valent. It's going to have nine
Ooh,
strains.
Ooh, fancy upgrade.
Yes, definitely.
Now, if I've been vaccinated, because I got Gardasil, the four-strain one, can I get the nine-strain one?
You can. We don't have. You certainly can.
Okay.
There, whether or not you're going to be able to convince a payer to pay for it is another story.
Yeah, it's pricey.
We don't have any reason to think that there's any downside to doing that, mm-hmm. but it's expensive.
And if you have teenagers in your household or relatives or
preteens,
get them vaccinated
11
before
is
they
the,
start.
Exactly, 11 is the most target age because then we know. Mostly, unless things are tragic, that we're getting somebody before they're going to start playing.
Yeah. Ah, so important.
It's really important. That's probably the most important thing we said today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll brag. I'll be like, yeah, got my second Gardasil injection. Getting vaccinated, you guys? You guys? Like get all cocky about
it. Well, you suck at parties.
Literally.
Yeah. Oh, hey.
Sometimes.
You do get pretty good protection after just two.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm. Great.
You want to get all three, though, but great. you get the majority of the protection after two.
All right. Patty, Dave, thank you. This was highly informative. Lots to think about. Lots
yeah.
of brainy.
See you next week.
Oh, we're going to talk about sex more. Yeah.
Look, like we've never done before.
Go team fun.
Bye-bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.